He was not angry because merchants were selling in the temple. Jesus was angry because the sacred struggle had been exchanged for shallow ease. The costly call of faith had been replaced with the cheap comfort of convenience. Endurance had been abandoned for efficiency. The refining fire of devotion had been forsaken for the lukewarm flicker of familiarity.
That's the Reverend Dr. Damon P. Williams. And today, he brings you a message entitled Comfortable Space, Corrupt Spirits. I'm Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to episode 4215 of Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. Happy New Year and welcome to our first episode of 2026. Today, to start the new year, we are pleased to welcome the Reverend Dr. Damon P. Williams, Senior Pastor of Providence Missionary Baptist Church in Southwest Atlanta. In addition to his pastoral work, Damon serves as the Assistant Professor in the Practice of Practical Ministry and Co-Director of the Baptist Studies Program at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Damon also stands out from his highly regarded preaching colleagues in that he is also an industrial systems engineer. He serves as the Associate Dean for Outreach and Engagement at Georgia Tech's College of Engineering. A native of Maryland and a proud graduate of Georgia Tech, Damon earned his doctorate at the University of Michigan and pursued theological training at Columbia Theological Seminary, where he was a Columbia Honors Fellow and an FTE Ministry Fellow.
Reverend Dr. Damon P. Williams, welcome to Day One.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is so much to ask you and find out, because you live at this remarkable intersection of academic leadership and pastoral ministry. You serve as the associate dean at Georgia Tech while also leading and shepherding a historic Atlanta Baptist congregation. So explain, how does this work out and how did it happen?
You know, God loves to make jokes with our lives. So I began my journey in academia as an engineer. Very strong in math and science. I've always loved math and science. Went to Georgia Tech for undergrad. Left to do several degrees at the University of Michigan with the sole purpose of coming back and joining the faculty. And while I was at Michigan, I entered the ministry with the expectation that I thought God would maybe have me be a minister of Christian education. Never my wildest dreams that I think that I would become a pastor of a church. But when I came back to Atlanta while I was in seminary and working at Georgia Tech, a church opened up and my pastor told me about it and wanted me to apply. And next thing you know, I was doing both. And interestingly, I tell people, I do more engineering at the church and I do more pastoring on campus.
Oh, say more about that.
My engineering field is industrial and systems engineering. We love to take these models of randomness and bring some level of order to them, to bring some level of structure to them. We look at large scale systems and try to optimize them to maximize the benefit of people who engage in these systems. And that's what pastoring is. That's what the church is. It is a large scale system with very diverse stochastic processes called congregants and visitors and community members. And my job is to bring all those random variables together and try to bring some level of order out of that while getting them to look more at Jesus than they look at anything that's going on around them. So that's a big engineering task. Whereas on Georgia Tech's campus, I've got a bunch of 18 to 22-year-olds who are trying to find themselves.
God bless you for that.
All the things they need. They don't need more math. They don't need more integrals and derivatives. They need a little more Jesus. And so I end up sharing the gospel just by the way I interact with them, just by the way I love them and try to take care of them and try to help them identify their purpose for why God put them on the planet with this degree that they're getting at Georgia Tech. And the pastoring on Georgia Tech's campus is less about me proselytizing or proclaiming the gospel, because I certainly don't do that. It's more about me living and walking on that campus as a Christian. And when people ask me who I am and why I am the way that I am, everything about me should espouse my faith as it was trained to me, you know, since I was baptized.
You also are married to a theologian and a Christian leader.
Yes, ma'am. I am married to the better preacher in my household, the Reverend Dr. Kalia J. Williams. So she's an associate dean at Candler School of Theology at Emory University. We actually met in seminary at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. And so the best thing about being married to a theologian, to be married to a scholar, being married to an academic, is I have someone who I can bounce ideas off of for ministry. She is a worship expert. I have someone who I can talk to about the ways in which people who are older than me or younger than me or different gender than me or different sexual orientation than me are going to hear and experience my sermon, and I get wonderful feedback from her. The worst thing about being married to somebody who's a better preacher than you is that drive home after the Sunday sermon. You said this. Let's talk about your exegesis of the text. So since she knows the Bible better than I do and actually preaches better than I do, I get coached every drive home after the sermon on Sunday morning.
I love that. So for people who are thinking about discernment and they feel called in two ways, like as you did for ministry and engineering, would you say the lesson is do both?
The lesson is don't believe that you can't do both. I think that is one of the old school tropes that too many leaders of the church, you know, believe. For me, my brain is wired math and science. I need 5 + 5 to be 10. And in the church, 5 + 5 is never 10. And so I needed a place to go and work out this gift of math and science and certainty that God has given me so that I then could come into the truly variable, stochastic, uncertain world that is ministry. And it became necessary for me to be a healthy pastor. I tell people who are leaders in the church, it's very important that you have something outside of the church that gives you life, that gives you energy, that you thrive on, because that thing is what is going to keep you full, as the work of the church and the work of pastoring sometimes can be draining. Some people play golf. Some people are foodies. Some people like music. I'm just a nerd, and I like to do math problems.
I love that. You are an engineer leading a church. What are the things about engineering that Christian leaders really should know are important?
I think Christian leaders are engineers, whether they want to, whether they want to understand that, you know, or not. A lot of times engineers, particularly industrial and systems engineers, are brought into situations that have problems, opportunities to grow, opportunities to improve. And what is the church and what are the great people that come to church, but people who have growing edges and opportunities to improve? But the goal is to realize that a lot of systems that we deal with in this world are very dynamic and they're very variable. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. And that's what makes engineering so important, is that we figure out dynamic ways to solve some very complicated problems that have a lot of variability associated with them. And so this is what pastoring is. The way that you help one couple when you're doing marital counseling is completely different than the way that you help another couple. The prayer that you pray at the hospital room with one member is completely different than the prayer that you pray in the hospital room with another member. The celebration that you have when one person gets a new job is completely different than the celebration you have when someone is retiring for a job. This is a stochastic work that we do. And the ability to optimize what you are providing to all of these random variables called members of the church, guests who walk in the church, people that you serve in the community, that's engineering. And pastors do an excellent job at letting God use them to be, as Paul said, all things to all people.
A stereotype is that it's belief, deep conviction, as a Christian is difficult because it isn't the same as logic. Mm-hmm. Was that a tension you needed to resolve?
Not at all. I have found in my life in academia, my life being an engineer, getting to know so many different engineers, you know, across the nation and ultimately internationally, I have found that many of them are people of faith. You get to a point where you're smart enough to know there's so much I don't know, and that you have people who realize that when my knowledge gives out, that's when my faith picks up. You have people that are smart enough to realize Genesis does talk about creation happening in 7 days, but nowhere does it say a day is a 24-hour period as we understand it today. So is it possible that a day could have been millions of years, billions of years, trillions of years as it relates to the Bible, that the dinosaurs very well could have walked the earth. God just didn't feel like talking about them and had many other things God wanted to talk about and make sure that we knew other than the fact that it was a triceratops. God also knew that humanity would learn and would grow, and that we'd figure out about the dinosaurs on our own. But there were some other things about love, about grace, about forgiveness, about mercy. Those things God wanted to make sure that we got out of this great book that God provided to us in the Holy Bible. And so there, to me, there is no conflict, right? There's a communion. There's a togetherness between science and faith. And for many persons, the basic axiom of science is this is what we understand up to this point. Right? There was a time when we ran around here and we really thought the earth was flat. And now the majority of us are pretty sure that that is not the case. Right? So this is what we understood up to this point. When I was born, the idea that I would have a cell phone in my pocket to make calls to other people did not yet exist. And look at us now. Science continues to grow. We are finite up to a certain point. So we're smart enough to know there's so much out there that we haven't even discovered. But God has. Someone has. And for me and many other persons, we choose to believe our faith, not what we know, but what we believe, because our God has all that knowledge. Our God has all that understanding. And this is why we want to have a relationship.
Now listen for God's word as we hear from the Gospel of John, chapter 2, verses 13 and 14.
The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables.
Now, Reverend Dr. Damon P. Williams' sermon, entitled Comfortable Space, Corrupt Spirits.
Across the long story of human faith, one truth echoes through every generation. Closeness to God does not grow in the soil of comfort. It grows through discipline, devotion, and the willingness to deny oneself something greater than oneself. Every great tradition bears witness to men and women who chose the narrow road, the demanding road, the road where the desires of the flesh are restrained so that the call of the Spirit might rise. The history of holiness, my friends, has always been a history of discomfort. In the Judean wilderness, Jesus of Nazareth fasted 40 days and 40 nights. The sun scorched his brow, the stones burned beneath his feet, hunger pressed upon his body, yet his soul reached toward God. His fasting was not starvation, it was sanctification. He taught us that intimacy with God is born when the will of the body bows before the will of heaven. High in the Himalayas, Siddhartha Gautama sat beneath a Bodhi tree after relinquishing all the comforts of royalty. Through silence and fasting and severe austerities, he discovered the middle way. He entered enlightenment. In early Christianity, the desert fathers and mothers withdrew into barren landscapes clothed in coarse garments, sleeping on bare earth, believing that silence and suffering could cleanse the soul. It was the prophet Muhammad who climbed to the cave of Hira, praying through the night, fasting, listening, preparing himself until revelation arrived. It was Saint Francis of Assisi who stripped himself of wealth and privilege. He kissed the hand of the leper, and he embraced poverty as Lady Grace, finding joy in surrender. It was the Dalai Lama, exiled from his homeland, who still rises before the sun to discipline his mind in study and prayer. It's Mother Teresa who walked the crowded streets of Calcutta, touching the untouchable, feeding the dying, sleeping little and praying much, embracing what she called the discomfort of compassion. My friends, these witnesses across history remind us of a central truth. Holiness is not accidental. Holiness is disciplined. Discomfort becomes devotion. Sacrifice becomes sanctuary. And these leaders, these faith leaders, they taught us that if we wish to walk closely with God, we cannot cling to ease. We must pick up the cross and walk the harder road that leads to transformation. This is how we shall begin 2026. We turn to the second chapter of the Gospel according to John, and here, at the beginning of this year, we turn to a place where Jesus enters the temple. He overturns the table of the money changers.
And most people, when they read this text, they love the drama of the scene, this angry Jesus, forceful, cleansing his father's house. But I want us to pause and look at the story and ask a deeper question. Not what did Jesus do, but why? Why was Jesus angry? He was not angry simply because merchants were selling in the temple. Jesus was angry because the sacred struggle had been exchanged for shallow ease. The costly call of faith had been replaced with the cheap comfort of convenience. Endurance had been abandoned for efficiency. The refining fire of devotion had been forsaken for the lukewarm flicker of familiarity. The discipline of discipleship had been traded for the luxury of distraction. When Jesus entered the temple, he expected reverence. Instead, he encountered a marketplace. He expected prayer. Instead, he heard profit. He expected surrender. Instead, he saw sale. The sin, my friends, was not the selling itself. It was the spirit behind the selling. It revealed a deeper corruption, a spiritual marketplace where the heart had become transactional, where holiness could be bought, and where devotion was divided between God and gain. We all know what a marketplace is. It's a place of options, endless options. Consumers compare and choose and negotiate. Value is driven by preference. And the more options we have, the more we believe we are in control. But the more the heart indulges in choice, the more the heart will become divided. What Jesus confronted that day was not merely a marketplace of animals. It was a marketplace of ideas, a marketplace of spiritual priorities, a marketplace where convenience overshadowed conviction. A marketplace where people came to God as consumers rather than disciples. And friends, when the heart becomes a marketplace, Jesus cannot be Lord of all because he's no longer Lord at all. For in the abundance of options, Christ becomes only one option among many. In Jesus' day, the temple was the pride of Israel. It gleamed in the sunlight. It symbolized God's presence among the people. But the corruption crept beneath its marble floors like a serpent in the garden. Back then, if you walked into the temple, you did not first hear the prayers of the righteous. What you heard were the bleating of sheep, the cooing of doves, and the clinking of coins. A house of prayer had been transformed into a place of profit. And the spirit, my friends, had died. It had taken on a different form. Today, for us, companies like Amazon and Uber and DoorDash have mastered the art of fueling desire through the illusion of endless choice. Convenience has now become our God. Desire has become our habit. Consumption has become a way of life. Endless aisles have produced this endless appetite that we have, and the modern heart often mistakes the freedom of choice for the freedom of the soul. As it is today, so it was back then in the temple. Our society has changed where holiness is now bartered, devotion is priced, and the sacred loses its sacredness. Walking into this environment, Jesus declares, "Stop making my Father's house a marketplace." At that moment, he was not just diagnosing a sickness in the temple. He was diagnosing a sickness within the human soul. He saw worship reduced to transaction. He saw faith treated like merchandise. He saw prayer drowned under the noise of profit. He saw greed dressed in religious garments. And most troubling of all, he saw choice replacing conviction. This, my friends, is why he overturned the tables, not only the wooden tables in the temple, but he overturned the invisible tables in the human heart. Those tables that we all have, where greed sits in the chair that is meant for grace, where pride stands where prayer should kneel, where convenience crowds out communion. And so, my friends, on this, the first Sunday of 2026, the Spirit asks us today as we begin this new year, where have we turned our own hearts into marketplaces? Where must we overturn the tables in our lives? Friends, we must overturn the tables where spiritual life has become transactional instead of transformational. Too often, people approach the church asking, "What do I get?" instead of "What do I give?" But the call of Christ, we are reminded by this text, is not transactional, it is transformational. You and I are being called by this text to overturn the tables where production matters more than presence. Where modern churches count attendance, but we don't count anointing. Where we measure budgets, but we don't measure brokenness. Where we schedule programs, but we neglect presence. The table of the heart must once again become a dwelling place for God, not a factory for religious activity. We must overturn the tables where covenant has been replaced by commodity. Our culture packages grace as a product. We put prayer as a performance. We put worship as entertainment. But here in this text, the God of our ancestors reminds us that God did not deliver Israel from Egypt to build an economy of exploitation. God called them, just as God calls us, into an economy of justice and compassion and jubilee. Today, we must overturn the tables where empire has replaced divine will. Too often, the church mirrors the values of the empire, where efficiency and profit and hierarchy are the things that make our hearts beat, and our heartbeat then matches the marketplace more than we match the Messiah. But God's will, friends, cannot be reduced to the desires of the market. We must overturn the tables where consumption has replaced conviction. We must be reminded that consumer religion asks the question, "What has the church done for me lately?" But convictional discipleship asks, "What has Christ called his church to do for the world?" So I ask you today, how will you leave this message? Will you leave as consumers pleased with a well-preached word? Will you leave worship pleased with a beautifully sung hymn, a neatly arranged service? Or will you leave as participants in divine disruption, unsettled, awakened, ready to overturn the tables cluttering your heart and distorting our world? For Jesus did not come simply to tidy up the temple. He came to transform it. He came to break the chains of transaction and restore the movement of grace. God's house is not a franchise, it is a freedom. Not a marketplace, but a movement. And friends, today, so it is with your heart. Your heart is not a marketplace, it is a movement. A sacred sanctuary where mercy outweighs money, where conviction outruns convenience, where compassion pushes back complacency. God never intended the heart to be comfortable. God intended the heart to be consecrated. The marketplace is loud, yes, but the call of God is louder. The empire is persistent, yes, but the reign of Christ is eternal. Convenience is seductive, yes, but conviction is stronger. So today, go forth. My friends, my lovers of God, my leaders of faith, today reclaim the moral imagination of the church. Live not as traitors of religion, but as witnesses of the resurrection. Believe again that the tables of greed can be overturned. Believe again that the poor can be lifted. Believe again that the presence of God can dwell in the center of our common life. Leave this message determined to cleanse your temple. Renew your conviction. And walk boldly into the discomfort of discipleship. For when faith grows comfortable, holiness loses its power. When the church grows comfortable, the spirit grows quiet. And when God's people grow comfortable, corruption is never far behind. But when conviction rises, when courage overcomes comfort, when the kingdom is able to break forth, for comfortable spaces corrupt the spirit. But the Spirit of God still calls us into the holy discomfort where transformation begins. And so I ask you today, my friends, what will you reimagine? What table will you overturn? What marketplace in your heart needs cleansing? God bless you, day one, and may heaven smile upon you.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Dr. Damon P. Williams. For a free transcript of his sermon, Comfortable Space, Corrupt Spirits, you can visit us online at dayone.org. Now, if you're hearing this on the radio, don't miss today's full interview on the Day One Weekly Podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at dayone.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you're a Day One Weekly Podcast listener, just know our 25 and 30 minute radio versions air every Sunday. Have questions or thoughts or comments? Email me anytime about anything at all at host@dayone.org. For 80 years, Day One has shared messages of hope and unity, bringing together Christians from all walks of life. Can I tell you something lovely that I recently heard from a colleague who would not let me share their name, but would let me share this story? They have a New Year's resolution of generosity. And so, they are now making financial donations monthly to Day One, starting this month. This colleague told me that they are seeking to incorporate giving into their lives in the same way they do prayer and worship and Sabbath. Love that. In 2025, we dug deep into our digital infrastructures and we made it much easier to set up recurring donations on the Day One website. You'll see that when you go to dayone.org/donate. Setting up a recurring donation is not just a great spiritual discipline, it also really helps us plan as we think through what is possible with the ministry of Day One. Our recurring monthly donors are so important to us. So, to support this ministry, visit us online at dayone.org/donate or mail your contribution to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia 30319. Thank you for helping us bring light and encouragement to so many. Next week on Day One, the Reverend Dr. Damon P. Williams returns to the pulpit with a powerful message for the Baptism of the Lord Sunday. Preaching from Matthew 3, verses 13 through 17, Damon invites us to wade into the waters of Jesus' baptism and discover why this singular moment, never repeated, became the foundation of Jesus' earthly ministry. Don't miss, why was Jesus baptized only once? That's next week on Day One. Damon, what a sermon, and what a sermon for the start of the year. Many Christians hear this Jesus turning over the tables story as a passage about anger. It's often cited as the like, well, this is the time Jesus got mad kind of thing. And you frame it as a passage about systems. And you are an engineer and you work on systems. So the way systems sprout and drift and become distorted, why is it more important to see this as a systems thing than a Jesus angry thing?
Well, I think it's important to see it as both, right? Jesus was indeed angry. I think this is a both and, not an either or. Jesus was angry. People don't just flip over tables for no reason. the brother was clearly upset, you know, about something. But systems, unfortunately, sometimes exclude. And that is one of the greatest knocks on us as the church, that we are houses of worship that are more houses of intra-church comfort. And I can't get into the fraternity that is the church because I don't fit in with the people who have created a system that benefits them and not the community they've been called to serve. And they've made it convenient and they've made it comfortable for them. I think that's one of the challenges that you see in this text. We got this great house of worship, but while we have these people here, let's sell them things and let's engage them in the marketplace. Let's change the way they think as they walk through the door. So rather than coming here focused on God, they're focused on the things that are going to be pleasing to them. This is a self thing. And many systems that are created are intended to make things convenient and easier for self, to get us thinking more and more about ourselves. I mean, this is why we love Amazon so much. Amazon's not selling products that you really need. The majority of those products you were able to get at Walmart and Target. You love Amazon because that box comes right to your door and it frees you up to do other things. It's about self. The prices aren't that much better. It's about, hey, this is going to make my life easier. It's going to be better for me. Systems sometimes cause us to look internally, and the gospel of Jesus Christ says, well, if you look too internally, you forget to be a part of this great world that's out here and forget to be a part of this world as it relates to this great God who put you here. And so that's what the system, I think, in the text is calling us to be aware of.
One way of looking at this also that's so interesting is that what you're bringing to us today is the Christian call to work against hypercapitalism and the system that we're all living in. But you're an engineer. And in some ways, I found myself being like, but it's the engineers who brought us like frictionless experience with consumption. Is that the tension? You see how on one side of your life, engineering is constantly working to make it frictionless and so that we are just even better little doers and consumers?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the friction need not be in the experience. It has to be in the relationship. And see, this is where I think the text challenges us. Frictionless experiences are perfectly okay. Frictionless relationships don't exist. More that I look for frictionless experiences, I will then begin to look for frictionless relationships. And I won't go into the challenging communities, and I won't deal with the challenging narratives in my family, and I won't deal with the challenging issues in my own heart. Because what I love about Amazon and what I love about DoorDash and what I love about Uber Eats, I'm then going to start applying to my relationships, how I deal with myself and how I deal with other people. So yes, I want you to be excited that Amazon got you that lotion within 2 days. Yay, Amazon. 2 days free to get that lotion to your house so you're not ashy when you go out in the sun. But what I don't want you to do is expect that same frictionless experience from the relationships of family members and friends and neighbors and people who have political ideologies that are different than you. Because difference is how we have been called to come together on this globe together as a community. And that's not frictionless. And I think that that experience that people came to the temple looking for in this text, Jesus was railing against that experience because it's not going to be frictionless. Sometimes it's going to be heavy. Sometimes it's going to be difficult. And the thing about Amazon says you don't have to wait, but the Lord sometimes says you do. And so we have to be okay sometimes with delay and sometimes denial. And frictionless experiences make us resistant to delay and denial.
It also is the case that we live in an ecology where our vocabulary is so deprived. Like, for instance, you said choice gets mistaken for conviction. Mm-hmm. Let's unpack that a little bit. Like, what do you mean by choice gets mistaken for conviction?
You know, the fact that, you know, Amazon has a lot of choices, we try to bring that into the church, that we have diversity in our music, that we let the youth get up on Fourth Sunday. And by bringing these choices, we think that we're creating a church and ultimately a worship experience and ultimately a place of worship that is open and available to all. But our conviction should be that it's less about what we do inside the building and more about what we do outside the building. And most of our churches, mine and included, we do a whole lot of great work inside the building, but are we doing as much outside the building in the community that we have been called to serve in? And I think that's one of the, again, challenges of the text. People came into the temple to worship, but they actually were coming for commerce. But the needs of the people, for the majority of them, were outside of the temple.
Yes.
The needs of this society that you and I live in are not inside of these wonderful houses of worship that we have built. The hurting, the sick, the desperate, they are outside of these buildings. And we need to be there with them, loving them, serving them, caring for them, just as Jesus did in the Gospels.
Just to continue on this bit about choice versus conviction. See this not only in the church, but in parenting young adults or mentoring students, is that we are called these days to build our identity based on which things we choose. Even taking my daughter to university tours, there was a whole thing like, we're the best school because we will give you lots of choices. Now, what you said in the sermon is choice mistaken for conviction. That word conviction, we barely know what it means. It means belief. What does it have to do with like building our identity? Like if I'm explaining this to people who are in a secular soup, which you are with students, how do you even describe what conviction means as opposed to choice?
Yeah, so I end up having this conversation with my students a lot. I try to explain to my students your life, your true life is based upon who you are on the inside, not what you do on the outside. Yes, I am an associate dean at Georgia Tech. And yes, I am the pastor of Providence Missionary Baptist Church. Those are things that I do. That's not who I am. My identity is a child of God trying to live out the gifts that God has given me in the world in which I serve. And that can be lived out independent of Georgia Tech and independent of Providence Missionary Baptist Church. I tell my students, you're going to get this great degree and go get this great job or start this great business or work in government or nonprofit. But if one day, if that place of business were to tell you that you can no longer be employed there, I don't want you to fall apart because who you are is not what you do. And the choices that we have, many of the choices that we offer people have to do with what's on the outside of them. And the reason many people get stuck in the paralysis of analysis is because there's nothing on the inside of them guiding those choices. So the more choices they are offered, the more difficult it becomes for them to make decisions. But it's a lot easier to make decisions when the inside of you is guiding your movement, guiding your thoughts, guiding your belief system.
I love that. Damon, you shared that when your certainty as an engineer ends, your faith takes over. And that's such a powerful image. I want to ask if there's a space between those two realms. What happens when you find yourself standing on the beach between the engineered earth and the ocean of faith and belief? Can you share a moment from your life when maybe you felt on that beach between them?
Yeah, you know, I feel that moment far too often. It is the moment when I get summoned to the hospital. Oh. And when I walk in, the doctors walk out. And I remember my first time doing this, first year on the job, first month on the job, I get summoned to the hospital. And they said, the preacher's here, and the doctor started walking out, and the nurses started walking out. And I was like, whoa, 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 hey, hey, hey. Where are you guys going? And they were like, for all intents and purposes, buddy, we've done all we can do. This is where you take over, right? We've done all the medicine. We've done all the vital checks. We've done everything that our knowledge allows us to do. Everything that's going to happen with this human being, this life that is before us now, is going to be based not on science, you know, but on faith. Yeah. And that moment happens to the minister all the time.
Yeah.
Before God's word, final word is brought, and a loved one either gets off a hospital bed and goes home or gets off the hospital bed and goes home, both homes, hopefully you caught me.
Yes.
That middle ground.
Yeah.
That's the space that you describe. And can I keep people trusting and believing? And can I use the word that the God we love gave us? Can I use that word to bring comfort to that uncertainty? Now, if you can understand that uncertainty in the hospital room, that same uncertainty occurs in our relationships. That same uncertainty occurs on our jobs. That same uncertainty occurs so many different times in our lives. And the key to navigate that uncertainty without turning to alcohol. Oh my God, I have to have a glass of wine. The key to navigating that uncertainty, instead of saying, I gotta put a blunt in my mouth and smoke some marijuana, or I gotta find somebody to have sex with. But the key to navigating that uncertainty is to depend on the same faith that got you through in the hospital room. That's the same faith that gets you through and when it's uncertain on your job, the same faith that's uncertain in its relationship. And those are the difficult times. That's when the value of a relationship with God is powerful. Sunday morning when everything is going well and everybody's praising God and singing your favorite hymn, that's the easy times of faith. But people who have truly walked with God will tell you, when I really needed God, when I really needed to depend on my faith, it got me through what other people would have viewed as a horrendous situation. But was horrible for them was actually peaceful for me because I was able to experience this faith that I have.
Yes. At the top of 2026, when disruption and discomfort feel very familiar to people, what's a word to people who already feel, whew, I feel disrupted and uncomfortable like crazy? What?
This is the perfect time. Perfect time. Lean in. Lean in. Running away to what is comfortable is actually going to pull you further away from your faith and pull you further away from God. Maybe if God rules and super rules over the world, then some of the things that we're experiencing in this world are intended to disrupt us and dislocate us and make us uncomfortable. This is the time not to miss prayer meeting, the time not to miss Bible study, the time not to miss calling friends and checking in with each other, the time not to miss worship, the time not to miss small group, the time not to miss ministry activity. Lean in and let God let you know, I can give you peace on the inside in spite of the turmoil going on the outside.
Damon, I'm so excited that you're coming back next week because I have so much more to ask you. And thank you so much for being with us and for bringing us such a strong word.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back. And I look forward to returning.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays. And we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media, You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. May the grace of God be with you on day one and every day yet to come.